Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Peace of mind comes as standard with a Kia 7-year warranty.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at RTE.ie. I'll go to Eileen first. Eileen Brady. Eileen, how are you?
Hello, Joe. Thank you for taking my call.
And thank you for making the call. Eileen, what's your situation?
I'm in a dreadful situation, really, because I have a very rare illness, which is very well looked after by my GP and four consultants I have.
Okay.
And now, since this row with Simon Harris and the consultants, he's removed all my care, and I have no care. So if I become ill, I have no idea where I go, or what I do, or who will even look after me.
So your consultant has gone into the public system?
No, she's supposed to sign a contract.
Yeah.
There's four. I have four consultants. I know it sounds terrible, but I have a very good life under these people. They look after me very well.
Okay.
But my consultant rang me the other day when I heard a man on O'Rourke saying that his consultant couldn't look after him anymore. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. I heard him.
And that was the first time I realised that I was in the same situation, that I have no care. I knew the public, the private hospitals had been taken over. I didn't have a problem with that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, she rang me and she explained to me that this contract, if she signs it, she is not allowed to care for me. She can care for public patients, but not for me. So all the patients and all the years that I've been looked after by her, they're just gone.
And what did she say? Did you say you were talking to your consultant?
She rang me, yeah. I left a message with her to see where I stood, see what the position was, and she rang me back and she said that she hadn't signed the contract at that stage because she knew she wouldn't be able to care for me. But she said if she could care for me, she would have signed it. And she said she would have signed it regardless of what the conditions were, providing that she could care for the patients that she already had. But she's not allowed to do that. So I'm left now. I emailed Simon Harris and I got no reply. I emailed Louise O'Reilly and she did reply to me very quickly and said that I'd be entitled to a care package under the HSE. But the nearest hospital to me is Cavan and they don't have an endocrinologist, which is what I would need. So I don't know if I get ill, where do I go, who do I see? No one seems to be able to tell me. And what I need now, what I want now, I want Simon Harris to sort out this contract with the consultants so that they can still treat people like me as well as whoever else he wants them to treat.
And Eileen, you're on medication, obviously.
Yeah, well, I've been on medication. I have to take medication every day of my life. I take very powerful steroids. And if I don't, I won't live regardless. I'd live for about 4 weeks. And it sounds very dramatic, but that's just how it is. But it's a fragile condition and it needs to be monitored carefully. And it's not every... There's one person in 100,000 maybe has what I have. So it's not every endocrinologist even that would be au fait with what I have and how to mind me. And these people look after me extremely well. And I live here in the country where I don't have, I don't need to be able to, you know, I can live where I like this. I go to my GP, he rings them, they bring me in maybe, if I get ill, maybe twice a year. They put me on a steroid drip and they give me whatever I need. And within a few days, I'm home and I'm fine. But my life is actually at risk now because if I get ill, it could happen quite quickly and I have no idea.
That's what I was going to ask. So it can come up. Your condition is ongoing, obviously. The medication is critical, but the condition can deteriorate quickly and you do need.
Yeah, yeah.
But then would you not just go to A&E? How would that...
Well, the last time I went to... I've had to go to A&E a couple of times. And I know... You see, they don't even actually know in A&E how to deal with this complaint. But there's no point to me going to A&E in Cavan because they don't have an endocrinologist anyway to instruct them on how to care for me. And I know that Aoife, the girl who runs the Addison's Association in Ireland, she went to the Mater one night with her mother when she was in a crisis. And she was told by a young doctor in A&E that she couldn't be on hydrocortisone because you only take it by injection, not by tablet, which is quite wrong. But, I mean, it's just that they're not aware. You know, they wouldn't be aware of it because it's rare. So I'm in a very precarious position, along with a whole lot of other people, I presume.
Yeah.
You know,
and are all of your consultants off the radar, so to speak? Are they?
Yeah, yeah. But and the main one I need, there's two mainly. There's one who looks after my Addison's, and there's another girl there who, any complications I have that are not Addison's but maybe caused by my own, she looks after that. But I would have to go now and try and find a doctor who knows what I have and how to treat it. And then I would have to find doctors in the same hospital, I presume, to try and deal with my other conditions. And then it's ludicrous, the position. I've 20 years I've looked after my own healthcare, and now it's been removed from me. just spoken with him.
Yeah, and it's as if you didn't have enough to worry about, Eileen. You sound you have a great way about you, so to speak.
Well, but, I'm very well looked after, and yeah. I can live a very good life with the care that I get. And all I want, I've tried to start a petition. It's called Reinstate Our Healthcare, and it's on change.org. And I'd ask anybody who's in my position or anybody who would like to support me to sign this petition to make Simon House deal with the consultants. And when she consulted a lawyer who specialises in contracts, he advised her that she couldn't sign this contract because it was so confusing that even the lawyer couldn't make head nor tail of it. So if you just give them a simple contract that they can treat whatever patients...
But if she didn't sign the government contract, which basically brings her into the public system and they decide who she'll treat, if she didn't sign it, can she still not deal with you, so? Because
she can deal with me over the phone, but she can't admit me because where is she going to admit me?
Well, that's true. She's no bed, yeah.
No. And my problem is that I do need to be admitted. I have to go on a steroid drip and I need very specialised care when I'm in there. So, you know, okay. I don't mind if he says, right, we're holding on to the private hospitals. Fair enough. But at least give her the right to admit me somewhere, you know, and other people like me who need that kind of care. The man on Shauna Road has a very unusual lung complaint, and he's in the same position. His consultant can't look after him now. You know, and if you go to a strange doctor, then I have to go back through 20 years of my care and what's been done and tests. Yeah. And, you know, I'm too old for all that.
Stay with us, Eileen. Let me bring Helen in, because another cancelled. What's your situation, Helen?
Hi, Joe. Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I actually am just a new mother to a baby boy. He was born in February, and when I was in the care of the Rotunda, they noticed, the lactation consultants actually noticed that I had, a symptom of breast cancer. So they referred me from the Rotunda to St. Vincent's Hospital to the symptomatic breast clinic. Mm-hmm. Obviously waiting for my appointment. It's a 3-month wait. I've been through Vincent's for different symptoms previously with the breast cancer clinics that they run. A 3-month wait wasn't a surprise to me. It might be to some people. And so I was waiting until the end of April for my appointment. And then I got a text message to say that all appointments were cancelled and basically indefinitely. So obviously, you know, having just been pregnant previously and seeing that you have a symptom of breast cancer, when you're pregnant, actually breast cancer can actually go, you know, proceed much more quickly because of the pregnancy hormone. So I was really anxious to actually have that appointment, and I understood that it was, you know, it was cancelled and postponed for a reason. So last week I rang Vincent's Hospital to actually, you know, to see if I could get my appointment reinstated, because obviously as of May 18th, according to the road to the framework, if I'm reading it correctly, they should be reopening the health services and all this. So I spoke to the people at Vincent's, who were obviously excellent, and they gave me a lot of time and discussed it with me a lot. And they still don't know when they're reopening their breast clinics, their cancer clinics. So as of the 7th of May, they have no idea, and they're waiting on the government to figure out, like, to tell them when they can reopen and how they can reopen. So not least of that, so that's a 2-month delay, because let's say it's now mid-May nearly. So that's 2 months where they haven't been operating breast clinics for screening or for symptomatic clinics, or I'm not even sure how many different types of clinics they have. That's 2 months delay. Obviously, you know, the health service was already under pressure before COVID-19 happened. So if it's a 2-month delay now, how are they going to catch up on the backlog? And then if they have to introduce social distancing, which they were also saying they would have to do, the number of people they can take into a clinic is severely reduced. So the 2 months that they've missed, they won't pick up in 2 months because of it will take them so much longer to get through patients because of social distancing. So I'm really concerned as to when, like people are actually going to be seen. And the more that I got into this and I rang, you know, talked to different people, like, there are probably people in more precarious position than myself. I'm aware that there are cancer patients that have had their treatment suspended. And please God, there's nothing wrong with me and that I will go and that there will be nothing wrong with me. But if I have to wait 5 months it would be 5 months now if there was no delays with social distancing and when they restart. And that would be assuming they restarted
But the sting of your point is, government, you have it well written out here, government realisation that their actions will cause a much higher death count for other diseases as they have closed clinics and services, screening services, mm-hmm. etc. And who will be counting these as deaths, you ask, Helen, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, like, there's a risk-benefit here. Like, COVID-19 isn't going to kill everybody that it gets, but you can be damn sure if someone gets cancer, unfortunately, that the outcome isn't positive if it's not gone. You know, there's a timely impact. Obviously, we're very lucky that it can be treated these days, you know, a lot. But if it's not caught in a timely manner, then people are being pushed into different stages of it and potentially won't be able to be treated. And it's just, I just don't think it's acceptable.
Let me bring,
and the fact that there's no plan is what it was what I found you know, really unbelievable.
Can I come
that.
Back in there, Joe?
Yes, Eileen, of course you can. Yes,
I think that girl's point is very valid, because I'm not going to die from COVID because I'm cocooning. I've done everything I've done that I'm supposed to do. And if I do die from COVID, I'd be very, very unlucky. But I'm quite likely to die from my illness if it's not monitored properly and looked after properly. And I won't add up on a COVID death, but it'll still be a fatality, you know. So that's the point I'd like to make. She's quite right about that. And there's nothing being done about this.
Okay, I want to bring it, it's not directly related per se, but Dr. Tomás Ryan is Associate Professor of Neurosciences at Trinity College. Now, you may have read his article last week in the Irish Times, which was about contact tracing and how important it was. Tomás, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. What reaction have you got? It was a pretty detailed article last week. Really well argued. Loads of charts and statistics, which I know is your forte. Brilliantly communicated, I thought, even to the lay man and woman like myself. What reaction have you got, Tomás, from your concrete proposal that we need to outrun this virus with instant testing, instant results and instant tracing?
Yeah, well, Joe, a number of scientists, including myself, have become more and more concerned about how we're going to maintain an exit strategy from the COVID-19 situation. But obviously, this affects not just how we manage the disease, but the cases that we're just hearing about how it affects the rest of our health service, how it affects our economy, how it affects going back to school, and also how it affects just living going forward.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is that when we come out of lockdown, we're going to have thousands of active infections in the Irish population, you know, potentially more than we had when we went into lockdown. So while the lockdown was really effective, it only bought us time.
Okay.
And that time needs to be used, I think, much more effectively to make preparations for how we can get back to normality and stay there for the next year and a half or however long it takes to produce a vaccine. Mm-hmm. Now, this is really crucial, because if we don't get this right, then we're going to be facing further lockdowns in the near future.
Wow. So what are you proposing should be done now, Tomás?
The crucial thing is we need to move to a more active method of isolation. So currently, mm-hmm. we're effectively containing the virus by what I call universal isolation. So we're isolating everyone all of the time.
Okay.
And this works, but it's very, very blunt, and it's got huge collateral costs on us. We need to move to a form of particular isolation, mm-hmm. where we only isolate the people who we know have the virus or who are likely to have it. We only isolate them for a defined period of time. And if we do that, as is being done in South Korea and in Taiwan, then the rest of the population continues essentially as normal, and mm-hmm. we can get back to some kind of normality. Now, the challenge is, how do we do that? And to do that, we need constant information of who has it and who their contacts are.
Yeah.
And that means we need a contact tracing operation linked with a testing infrastructure that is reliable, rapid, and consistent.
Okay.
Now, my worry strongly is that whenever we hear about testing, what we hear is we're scaling up capacity, everyone's doing everything they can, and therefore it's just one of the things that we have to wait for. but it actually deserves much more of our attention and focus than I think we've been giving it, because it is the only way that we can have a realistic exit from lockdown and to stay out.
So we test. How soon after the test, ideally, in your theory, how soon after the test do we need to get those results?
3 days is for the entire process. 1 day for testing, 2 days for contact tracing. And it's not a theory.
So you get to, I know it, but you say on you have your test at 9 o'clock in the morning. You need to get a result that day.
Exactly. So, okay. What I mean by when I say Joe, it's not a theory. I mean it's just based on the facts of the virus. Now,
okay.
The crucial feature that people need to be aware of is this: people are spreading the virus before they show symptoms.
Yeah.
So you get the virus. You get symptoms then 5 days later. But at 3 days, you're spreading the virus to other people.
Yeah, before you.
Pre-symptomatically. Okay. And half of people who get infected with the virus don't get symptoms at all. They're just asymptomatic entirely. And currently, these people would be spreading the virus in the population.
Okay.
They're not, because we're under lockdown. But when we come out of lockdown, pre-symptomatic people and asymptomatic people will be spreading it in the population.
So the way we can target the asymptomatic people is by when we get a positive test. Okay, we come back to that case. 9 o'clock in the morning, you do the test. The result comes in at 7 o'clock that night, for argument's sake. Are they phoned immediately?
Yeah.
Okay. Are they phoned by someone who delivers the news that they're positive and they must self-isolate? And does that same person say, now sit down with me and give me the mobile phone numbers of the people you have been in contact with? Is that done and then?
That's what should happen.
And when are those people phoned?
Well, the whole contact tracing operation, if the testing situation happens in 24 hours, and that's not 24 hours from sampling, that's 24 hours from declaring yourself as symptoms. Then you have to arrange to get a swab test. Then you have to get the test and get the result. That should happen in 24 hours. And you've got 2 days to identify the contacts and to contact them. They need to be quarantined.
Yeah, okay.
So in advance of getting a test. And then they get a test. And if they test negative, they can go about their lives. If they test positive, well, obviously, they're going to have to isolate for 2 weeks.
And Tomás, do you see the urgency of this requiring a 24-hour service? Do you follow me? In other words, you get your tracing list. You get your positive result at 7 o'clock that evening. God forbid, you get your list of contacts from that person. You get the mobile phone numbers or emails or whatever. And this, do you start ringing them that night? Saying,
yes, I think that testing and tracing and all of it needs to be essentially 24/7.
Okay.
And it's greatly going to be aided by electronic contact tracing,
which I think
is going to have to be a crucial component of this.
And what does that entail?
Well, there's a trade-off between privacy and effectiveness. In South Korea, when people tested positive, the government used their credit card records, their phone records, their health records, and CCTV footage in shops to identify who they were in contact with.
Wow.
We probably don't want to go that far, but we'll probably have some kind of a Bluetooth app that allows us to take record of who we've been in contact with. So you could have a situation whereby if someone tests positive, their phone might tell them who they were in contact with during the period where they were infectious. And those people would get a message to say, you have to self-isolate now until you get a test. And we need a degree of enforcement of this.
Mm.
But, Joe, all of that is the next stage of development. The first stage is that we need a testing framework that can happen in 24 hours. And currently, even the most optimistic situations are saying tests are taking about 3 to 4 days. That's not going to work, because if you take 3 or 4 days for testing and you take a couple of days for contact tracing, you're not doing anything to prevent the spread of the virus in the community, and you may as well not be doing it.
So you're saying we have to outrun the virus, basically. We've got to get ahead of it. Okay.
We don't have a vaccine. We don't have an effective pharmaceutical treatment. The only weapon we have is isolation. We need to hunt it down. We need to separate it from people as much as possible and let it die out. And if we do this properly, because we're on an island, we can actually get this very much under control within a matter of months. And we could actually be prepared then for other pandemics that might arise in the future. So this type of infrastructure would be a good investment. But so far, it hasn't exactly been forthcoming.
And the reason why South Korea were so quick off the mark is that they had planned for a pandemic, and in fact they have a touch of one a few years ago. Anyway, they had planning in place for a pandemic.
Exactly.
Hadn't they?
Yeah. Exactly. The reason that South Korea and Taiwan were so prepared for this was because of their previous experience with the MERS epidemic.
Okay,
and
yeah.
So they knew exactly how to deal with this.
Okay.
And South Korea is the model for us because they're a democratic society.
And you don't necessarily
want to be doing things exactly the way, say, China did things.
Mm-hmm.
So South Korea's approach, I think, would suit us very well. And the important thing is it's eminently achievable. We can do it. We can do it right now. Mm-hmm. We have everything that we need to do it. But so far, we're not doing it.
Okay. The article was published on Thursday, April 16th. What reaction have you got?
Well, the first article was published Thursday, April 16th. There was a follow-up last week, which was the longer form one. I've received generally a very positive feedback from pretty much everyone I've interacted with. It's very obvious to many of us that this is the crucial problem. And I think that when you look at the things that we need to get out of lockdown, you need to get the reproduction number of the virus down to a certain point.
Yeah.
We need to flatten the curve. That's obvious.
Yeah.
And that's happening. We need to have an appropriate capacity in our healthcare service. And we do. We need to have public health measures in place. And we do. We need to have basically this checklist of different things that we need. And one of them is you need to have a testing and tracing infrastructure. Now, whenever this comes up, we just hear that, we're scaling up, we're increasing our capacity, there are some problems with reagents. But the reality is there has been nothing but problems since March. And we have not adequately scaled up capacity. We have not shown that we can maintain the appropriate testing capacity on a day-to-day basis. It's no use saying you hit 15,000 tests in one day. You have to be able to hit 15,000 tests 7 days a week for months. Without fail.
But also,
the most important thing is speed. You need to have a fast turnaround time. It has to be that testing capacity with about 24 hours and not waiting days to weeks.
And also the tracing. The minute you get the result, you try and, as you say, South Korea obviously have a very sophisticated way of doing it through credit card contacts, obviously, etc. But you need to get the contacts that the positive COVID results have been in touch with, so to speak, and you need to get onto them rapid because they will not be showing. They'll be more than likely be asymptomatic if the speed is upped. And you need to say to them, listen, you must isolate and until you get a test.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't think that the people on the ground, the population, are going to find it that inconvenient. I think it's going to be, apart from the new normal, look, it's going to involve a lot of social distancing in physical spaces. We're not going to have crowded pubs, and schools are not going to be able to have full classrooms of 30 students, and we're going to be wearing masks in indoor spaces. These are all things that are going to be part of the reality. But the point is that everything will be able to happen, but not if we don't have sufficient containment measures in place. If we don't get control of the testing and tracing situation, we will be facing further lockdowns.
Okay, Eileen, do you want to? Yes, who's that?
Helen, can I come back in there?
Yeah.
So obviously, I don't disagree with anything that that the doctor has said, but the aim was to flatten the curve, and as far as they understand, the curve has been flattened, and yet we all, you know, we have to continue with social distancing. But that has to be practical as well, and social distancing is not practical if you're trying to clear a backlog of patients through cancer clinics, where they normally take 60 patients into a clinic, and now they can take very, very few compared to that number. How are they going to clear a backlog now of patients that they have, where there was already at least a 3 month wait, and now they've 2 months to catch up on? And it's same with the creches. Like, you cannot mind a child with social distancing. So social distancing isn't the answer to everything. And, to be honest, I'm kind of sick of hearing about social distancing. It's not actually possible to do that. And it's not possible to get the country back up and running without creches. And it's not possible to treat the people of Ireland through not just the breast cancer clinics, but smear testing clinics. And whatever else has been cancelled for the last 2 months.
I know that's not your area, Tomás, is it, as such?
Well, no, but I mean, I'm also a university professor, so I have to teach theoretically hundreds of undergraduates in September, and we don't know exactly what that's going to look like either. A lot of it is going to be online, of course. I think every sector of Irish society is going to face these problems. The reality is, life is going on in South Korea, but you need sensible precautions. The type of social distancing we have now doesn't necessarily apply into every circumstance. I mean, 2 meter physical distance in a restaurant between people having meals together is not going to happen, of course. And similarly, in classrooms, even with the kind of sparsely populated classrooms that we're seeing in other countries, it's not literally 2 or even necessarily 1 meter all the time between all students there. There needs to be very tailored guidelines in place for every type of situation with a reasonable degree of hygiene. And, of course, the risk involved in if a positive case emerges in a cluster of people that are regularly interacting together, such as in a school. As regards waiting rooms, I mean, we don't need to have 60 people in a cancer clinic at once. We just need to look at better ways of organizing the logistics around it.
The only thing is, Joe, if people like me can't be seen by our consultants and we're put into the public service, then that's going to be a massive increase in people who need to be dealt with by the public
service. I know, I take that point, but I think what's fascinating about what Tomás is saying, I think, is that on the one hand, Tomás, we organised the hospitals really well, City West, all the expanded ICU units. So we were very, very good as a country or as a public service in actually treating the cases, so to speak, the horrific cases. But we're not very good at preventing, at tracing.
No, exactly. I think that we did the lockdown really well. I think that apart from we should have stopped travel to Cheltenham and from Italy, and the nursing homes, of course. But we did the lockdown itself very well, and we did the ICUs really well. We have an ICU capacity that made sure we would have everything under control. There was no chance of being overwhelmed.
Is our system, the way it's constructed, better at treatment rather than prevention?
I think that when you have an emergency of this scale, the entire society pulled together reactively, and we did our job in the lockdown.
Okay, yeah.
And that's something that we can look back on. Apart from the awful nursing home situation, we can generally look back on this as something to be proud of. The problem is the prospective planning for coming out of this. And I think that it's really important that we take a good look at ourselves and see what's going wrong here. Because the money that would be required to produce a world-class infrastructure for containing this epidemic and any epidemic, which we could build right now, would be far, far less than what we heard today was going to be spent just on PPE in a year.
$1 billion, yeah.
Right. So it's not about money.
Okay.
Right? It's not about knowledge. Yeah. We have the knowledge. We know how to do it. The only thing that's keeping us from getting this done is organizational inertia.
And have you been, I'm sorry for hammering on about this, to use one of the phrases from your article, but have you been contacted by anyone, any of the powers that be? And one of the great revelations of this, I presume people knew, one of the great revelations of this to the public of this pandemic is the number of really, really, really sharp, well-educated, brilliant communicator experts, scientists and experts and medics and public servants that have emerged. People wouldn't have known their names publicly up to 10 weeks ago. But have you been contacted? Well, you were one of them, by the way, in my view, because I watched your TED Talks. When I read your article, I went, as most people do, I Googled you and Wikipedia'd you and tried to find out more about you. And I think you're only in your 30s, are you, according to... You're a young man.
As it happens, I'm 35. It's not that young. But Joe, there's lots of people like me. I mean, there's no reason why I would be necessarily needed to be contacted. I will say that the fact that the Joint Oireachtas Committee on COVID-19 has been set up is a very welcome development. And I think that's going to help catalyze a lot of change. But I think, to your point, we have a lot of people in this country who are well-positioned to help make this happen. Now, we're missing two things, in my view, at a practical level. We're missing proper scientific advice. Now, I don't want to criticize NPHET or the people who are trying to manage the public health side of things, because I think they're actually doing a very, very good job at managing the public health side of things. But the problem is the testing tracing problem. It's more of a science problem than a public health problem.
Okay.
And the public health committee and their advisory group are pretty much entirely medical doctors. They're not really representing a broad base of scientific expertise, and not that which we do have in this country. So my concern is that the exit strategy has not received sufficient scientific orientation. And the other thing is you need to be able to get things done quickly. So though what I'm saying, what we need for testing, tracing, and isolation, though I'm saying it's eminently doable, and it is, it's also, you know, a huge industrial job. It has to move fastly and without mistakes. You're going to have so many problems and so many bottlenecks. You need people who really, really know how to deliver quickly on a day-to-day basis. And that's why I think the private sector is going to be so important. And we have a thriving biotechnology and pharmaceutical sector in Ireland. And they all want to help. They all want to get involved. They want to bring their knowledge, their expertise, their energy, and their infrastructures to helping towards this. So the point I'm making is that we have a huge scientific capacity in this country. Mm-hmm. We have a huge industrial capacity in this country. But when you delegate this job to subcommittees within what are essentially public sector organizations, things just aren't going to happen at the pace that we need them to happen. And I really don't say that as a criticism, because I know that every single individual who are doing the work on tracing and testing in Ireland right now are flat out. I know they're being innovative. I know they're pushing down boundaries. I know they're doing more than they can. But the organizational structures that we have in place for dealing with this are just not going to be able to do what we need them to do.
You think there should be a minister for COVID, isn't that? Didn't I read that in one of your pieces?
Yeah, I think that we need a senior minister.
Okay. That's his or her total remit.
Exactly, because I think that, you know, the reality is you can't have people in the HSE bringing in outside help from scientists and industrialists who are not normally employed in the civil service, because that's not a legitimate way of working. You need a leader in the political arena to take control of this. You need a senior minister with their hands on the situation, holding the reins and accountable for what's going on, in daily contact with the Taoiseach and communicating with our leading scientists on a regular basis. And then this minister should convene a special task force that would be including the main players in the HSE and Department of Health that are overseeing testing and tracing, but also industrial leaders from biotech and also our leading scientific minds. And if you put that together with the leadership that would be afforded to it, I think that then you could see a very rapid change in this country. And I think that we could be one of the leading countries in Europe for how we exit this, which will have huge economic advantages. I mean, it shouldn't escape anyone's attention that the faster we get out of this, the more we benefit from the secondary effects. And this isn't about the science versus the economics. This is about getting back to normal life. And when we get back to normal life, the economics will take care of itself. We're an island. We should have had the same opportunities that New Zealand had to keep this at bay. We still have those opportunities if we can get this right.
Okay. I've retweeted your article there as well. It's just a fascinating... it's not an argument. It's a fascinating logic. There's an incredible concrete logic to it as well. Outrunning the virus is the best way I can to describe it. Tomás, what is your own background? Like, where are you, Bree? Because you're a scientist, you probably get a bit coy on me, but where are you from?
I'm from Waterford.
Okay, what was your...
Originally.
And when did you develop an interest in this whole area?
When did I? Well, I mean, I'm a general biologist and that I've moved between many different fields in my own career. I started out as a genetic student at Trinity, and then I became into molecular neuroscience in the United Kingdom. Spent some time in the United States in Boston, where I became mainly a systems neuroscientist, and now I'm running a research group in Trinity, where we look at the intersection partly of the brain and the immune system.
Okay.
You know, COVID-19 is not my research area of expertise, but I think that the feature of how we deal with this is that it's like many things in biology, it's interdisciplinary. You don't just have one type of scientific expertise relating to it. You need to put together many different parts in order to make a picture of what's going on. And I think that that's one of the things that we're not really doing at the moment in Ireland, because I think that most of the scientific expertise that we're using in our decision-making seems to be just a copy and paste of what's happening, what the World Health Organization are releasing. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, the World Health Organization have very clear insights into, obviously, know exactly what's going on. But you also have to remember that the World Health Organization is a one-size-fits-all thing.
Okay.
So what they say about masks, about whether or not we should be mandating masks or even having a policy for everyone to be wearing masks. By the way, we should be doing that. We need to be wearing masks in public places, particularly indoors.
Okay.
Well, but the World Health Organization, what they say has to apply to Sierra Leone, and has to apply to Chile, to apply to every single country in the world.
Okay.
Similarly, the European Commission, when they give advice, they can only tell us what to do, but they can't tell us how to do that. So we have to tailor our own strategy to our own country.
So again, you're in no doubt about face masks, obviously.
No doubt about face masks.
Okay.
But I think that we need to be assimilating the best scientific knowledge much more quickly, because it's changing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that the current structures allow us to do that, because we're waiting for scientific advice to be filtered all the way through things like the European Commission and the World Health Organization before we act on it.
That's where a ministry and a minister for COVID would help.
Exactly.
Okay. Absolutely fascinating. Tomás, again, you'll go coy on me. We haven't gone coy on me so far. At the beginning of your TED Talk, which is up there, when did you do the TED Talk?
That was in 2016, 2017.
You were about 14 and a half or something. But anyway, you're still only 35. I'm not. But at the beginning of the TED Talk, which is about memory and neuroscience, and it was absolutely fascinating. But at the beginning of the TED Talk, you opened it by saying, when I was 11 years of age, I was in a head-on collision.
Yes.
Between a bike, you were on the bike, and a car.
Yeah, I was driving out of a cul-de-sac, and I didn't see a car coming around the corner, and about 30 miles an hour or so.
Yeah.
I don't really remember much about the following few days, but now I work on memory. That's not why I work on memory, but it's...
But you use it to illustrate that you have no memory of the subsequent events after the car and your bike collided head on.
And not for a few days after that, actually,
But you're well, obviously. Were you always a genius? I don't know how I came across this. When I was reading the article, let's say I went looking for more things, I came across your criteria for becoming a student in your lab in Trinity, in that whole area, neurosciences. But most of your criteria were about philosophy, curiosity, communications. It was a real insight for me. I thought you were just going to look for high grades in maths and biology and physics, but you have a big emphasis on philosophy, communications, multidisciplinary, be interested in other things. You also say, remember, very few scientists make a lot of money. It's like being, and you actually use the phrase, coming back to me now, you use the phrase, it's like being an artist.
In many respects, it is, but I think, we're talking there more broadly about education, in Ireland, we have this sort of tendency that you kind of are what CAO course you get into.
Yeah.
This sort of view that once you choose that, that's what you're going to be your starting job after college, and that then that's going to be your career. I think we need to move more and more away from that kind of mentality. I think that one thing that I learned when I was a student at Trinity was that most people end up doing something entirely different to what they thought they would end up doing. And that's the most important thing about education, is that students need to study whatever they're most interested in, because that will allow them to discover the things that they're passionate about in the future.
Okay.
It's the thing that you're most passionate about that you're going to be good at.
Yeah.
So I kind of like to select scientists to work in my group based on their attitude more than their skills, because anyone can learn the skills as they go along.
Fascinating. I'm sorry for Liveline, that went on much longer than normal, but I think it's worth it because I thought, and a lot of people think what you're saying is not just sensible, but logical. Dr. Tomás Ryan, Associate Professor of Neurosciences at Trinity College Dublin, Gurumila Mahaka, 51551 Mashan. People who have children with special needs and the day centres are shut down. Miriam Jennings. Miriam, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your situation, Miriam?
My situation, I'm here in Galway. I've got two boys with autism turning 13. One of my boys has very complex needs, severe intellectual disability. We are no further along here. We are. We're nearly 10 weeks now. Our special education system is just left behind. Our children are in classrooms with very low ratios. The government need to look at us now. They need to look at special education, the carers of Ireland and parents and extended families.
And you're saying really the special education needs of children with complex needs should be a priority in terms of trying to get back up.
Absolutely. Yeah. These children, some of them are just 4 to 5 in a large classroom pod with various rooms in it. What in God's name is the delay with looking at restarting our services? I understand we need to be careful, protocols need to be put in place, but do they realise the regression in years we are losing while we stand here? It is absolutely deplorable.
Okay, and as I said, I heard these stories over the last 3 weeks from people like yourself, Miriam, and we'll do more, anyone who wishes to contact us, to highlight that situation,
people with special needs need
priority return in this scenario. Miriam Jennings, we'll keep in touch.
Our Department of Education, Health need to look at this now.
Okay, here. Thanks, Miriam Jennings, and kind regards to you and your family. It's Miriam Jennings in Galway.